Welcome to the Language Mastery Show, a weekly podcast bringing you expert tips for getting fluent anywhere in the world. I'm your host, John Fotheringham. For show notes, visit languagemastery.com/show. Daniel Rustin is an author, full-time traveler, digital nomad, short-term rental expert, and a former Airbnb employee. He is best known for his books, Optimize Your B&B and Profitable Properties, but he has also written a book on language learning, Zilch to Conversational. In our conversation, Danny shares why he failed to learn a foreign language's first two attempts, the methods he used to finally reach conversational fluency in Spanish, and how to choose the right language teacher. He also talks about how to use Anki spaced repetition flashcards, why you should learn the IPA, or International Phonetic Alphabet, and why you should start with sounds and then move on to phrases, sentences, and grammar in your target language. All right, without further ado, enjoy my conversation with Daniel Rustin. Excited to be joined by a legend in the Airbnb space, and I didn't realize it was also a language lover. So tell us a bit about your language background. I know you, in your book, Zilch to Conversational, you mentioned that you had three attempts to learn foreign languages. The first two were not successful. So tell us a bit about why the first two times didn't work and what changed the third time around.
I don't know if I put this in the book, but I started learning Mandarin. Did I say that?
You did not, which is interesting. That's kind of one of my favorite languages. So go on.
My parents recommended me do Mandarin, and it was probably a good recommendation. This was in like 2002. And they're like, they're a business. They're going to take over the world. You might as well learn Mandarin. You're like a business dude. So I started, but I did it for just a week. And I was in high school, and this is just not the right time to learn languages, unfortunately, for me at least. You know, you're maturing, you've got hair popping out your armpits, you're like right. Starting to attract girls, you're playing sports. And so I switched quickly over to Spanish because that's where most kids were doing in high school. And I didn't want to be a loser, which I kind of was a loser anyways, but that's another story. And I learned that for 3 years. And I'll never forget this. I had an epiphany. I remember I was downstairs and I decently wanted to learn Spanish. I wasn't that forceful about it, but I had, you know, if there was a subject that I would learn at home, I would do that. And I had this epiphany where just like the language seemed to make sense. Just all of a sudden, oh, I get it. And I've been waiting for that epiphany to come back to me ever since then. And it hasn't, unfortunately.
Same.
Now it's hard to explain, but I don't know exactly what happened. So I'd say I'm conversational. I say fluent is like native fluent. So I'm good enough. I want to get much better. I want to get to a near fluent level, including the accent.
Like C2, if you were to put into the CFR, which I know has problems, but I think for reference point of view, it's decent enough.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I have my own scale. My scale is like being able to be in a group conversation at a party with noise and understand what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned a few of these terms I liked in the book about those different levels. I know like trickster, I thought was a really fun word to describe. Levels.
Oh my God, I'm
putting you on the spot.
I honestly can't even remember. So this book, Zilch to Conversational, I wrote it a little bit soon in my language learning journey. I had just published a book in the Airbnb space that turned out to do very well. And so I was like, hey, I'm an author. You know, a year had went by. I was like, let's write another book. So I wrote this book and I had been to Eastern Europe for 3 months and I started learning Russian, which I did in a very different way, just basically memorizing a bunch of stuff as I can. What are they commonly going to say? And I had also learned a little bit of Portuguese and Spanish as well, but languages don't come natural to me. So like how I did it was I would be in Latin America for 4 months, I'd learn Spanish. And then I'd be away for 8 months and I would forget Spanish. Some people just get it. I've got a friend here who's a local Colombian. He gets it. He could say different accents. He has no accent when he speaks English. I think I've corrected him like once in 5 years, but I wanted to learn Spanish. Like I like living in Latin America and I wanted to learn Spanish. So I think I'll bring it back to your original question, which was I tried various times to learn Spanish and I didn't. But I went to Vietnam in this 8 month gap. And I remember I there was a Spanish speaking couple there and I wanted to speak Spanish. So I spoke with them in Spanish, but I remember you know, I had forgotten most of my Spanish. It's hot in Vietnam, and I was now nervous. I was sweating profusely because I was just so nervous because I kind of forgot it. But I was so, anyways. That was my experience the first few years. Now I'm pretty good, even if I leave for 5 months, which I just went back to Asia and got back. But I tried the second time. So first high school, first time fail, total fail. Not the right time to learn it. There's some schools
in the U.S. Right way to learn it. I mean, let's be honest, most ways of teaching languages in schools, which is something we can get into more. I know that you also did some schooling in, I think, Guatemala it was. So
yeah.
Talk about that. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll get to that too. I'm glad you said that because I thought I was just strange. But the second time was when I had a real job. This was me like 2012. I got Rosetta Stone and I studied it pretty regularly for many months. And then I went to the military. So that kind of stopped that. But even then, I had no reason to use it. So I can't. So I kind of, that was the second time that I failed. The third time was when I went to Guatemala. And I remember taking it was a city called Antigua, Guatemala. I actually went to Guatemala. Oh, this is kind of a funny story. I went to Guatemala City, and that's where I wrote my first book. At the same time of writing that book, I was using Anki and learning flashcards. I was memorizing the top 500 words, I think, or 600, whatever, with a plan. All right, in January, I'm going to go to Antigua, Guatemala, and learn, take classes 8 hours a day, really get it. And so I thought that my first experience was like, all right, I had these 500 words under my belt. And I get to Antigua, I've got my house set up, I've got my school set up. So the house was, I think I mentioned this in the book, the house was supposed to be like at a local house, right?
Mm-hmm. Home
school. But when I got...
Air quotes here.
Yeah, exactly. The air quotes fits very perfectly here. I get to this house and I'm welcomed by a non-Spanish native speaker. I'm like, all right, you know, they're sharing the house with me too. This house turned out to be an entrepreneurial guy who created a house full of foreigners who didn't speak good Spanish, and they would have someone come over and cook breakfast, lunch, and dinner and speak with us for an hour, but they wouldn't really speak with us unless we spoke with them. And I didn't really know what to say. And I thought going there with my 600 words, you know, because you hear that stat, if you learn 600 words are used in 80% of the language. So if you learn 600 words, you know 80% of language. In theory, I suppose that's right. But
there's a big asterisk next to that.
Yeah. So I was feeling pretty confident. And I get to this house and I'm just, all of a sudden, my confidence just smacked to the ground. Because I'm like, I know 80% of the language. Why am I not understanding anything here? That was 2017. I think I just took a few weeks of classes because I just didn't connect with the teachers. The teachers spoke. I'd be curious to know what you think about this. The teachers didn't speak English in Guatemala. And I mentioned this in the book and I still agree with it now. When I'm learning a language at the beginning, the teacher needs to speak English. Explain to me the concept in 5 minutes and let's take 45 minutes to practice. I get where other people come from, where they're like, you should just learn Spanish from the beginning. I get that. But for me, it just didn't work. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's a very nuanced point because I think so often the people that argue for using English from the beginning are coming at it from a point of view of you can't learn if you don't understand.
You said learning English from the beginning, using English
to learn another language. Yeah.
Got it. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I agree with you. I think for the purpose of understanding how it works, it's just much more efficient. To your point in the book, it takes 5 minutes to talk about something that would take an hour or more to explain the target language, if you even understand it then. Because if you're an absolute beginner, you're not going to understand the explanation in the target language. I do think there's a little bit of nuance here where if the teacher is really, really good at what they do. So I worked at Blitz Taiwan. I lived in Taiwan. And their method is target language only. But the way they do it, I think, is very, very good. They use a lot of props and context. And it's possible, even at the very, very beginning stage, to do it. But it's really hard. Okay. Most people are terrible at it. And I think you're not going to likely find a teacher who can do it effectively from day one. So I agree with you. I think where it starts to get a little murky is when you get into the intermediate stage. They're used to having everything explained in English, and they never take the training wheels off and go to full target language practice. So that's kind of where I think it gets tricky, is if you train yourself to always expect and get used to, you know, L1, you know, your first language explanations, and you're used to that all the time, and then you keep doing that. So we only learn when we understand. Comprehension really matters. And brass tacks, you want to know, it's like, what is this? How does it work? And just tell me, give me the goods, right?
Yeah, I agree. I never found that good teacher. You should, my theory is switch to the local language, the target language as soon as possible, which would be like, you know, even advanced beginner. But I think I tell this story in the book too, but I switched schools, switched many schools. And I just remember thinking like, I use like tech. I'm from San Francisco. I was like the teaching technology, the way they're teaching it just doesn't connect with me. It's not efficient. I want to learn actual stuff from the get-go, like that I can use in real life. So I found a teacher though, who is one of the best teachers I've ever found. She's in Antigua. Actually, if you happen to go to Antigua and you go to my personal blog and you go to, I have two articles on there. One of them is about learning language in Antigua. Mm-hmm. I have her contact on there and I'd recommend you reach out to her. Her name is Anna.
Quick. So what made her unique? What made her so good?
What made her so good? That's a good question.
Or probably an easier question. What made the other teachers so bad?
I think partly is what I mentioned earlier is that she knew some English. None of the teachers spoke any English in any of the schools. Mm-hmm. She knew some English, which for me, learning any language is already frustrating. So now now I'm like going to a class and I'm not looking forward to it because I'm going to be frustrated the whole time. She spoke a little bit of English and this was 2017. So I can't remember exactly, but the way she explained things was clear, worked with my mind. Mm-hmm. How she analyzed languages and split them up. And so I still have a chart which broke down all the different tenses. And for me, I looked at that chart and I was like, okay, this makes sense for my brain. That's what I do now with teachers. I give them like one chance. If it's like a thinking thing. How do they think about the language? How I think about the language? Can they explain things to me in a way that just makes sense to me? That makes mm-hmm. the class more efficient. It's very hard for me to find that. I assume it's very hard for anyone to find who matches with you very well. I had one in here. I'm in Colombia right now, but she moved to New Zealand, unfortunately. Mm. And I love in-person classes.
Right. Have you ever learned with a non-native teacher? I'm curious. Fluent, but non-native teacher.
They would be fluent, but not native.
Yeah.
I don't think so. At least my best teachers that I'm thinking of, there's three. There was one in Guadalajara, Mexico. Mm. There was one in Playa del Carmen, Mexico. And there was one here in Medellin, Colombia. They were all native speakers. And two of them spoke native English, which was not necessary. One of the teacher here in Colombia, I'd never speak English to her. Which is interesting because like you have different personalities in different languages. Mm-hmm. And I think that's when you really get fluent. And so I don't know her English personality. Mm-hmm. I know only her Spanish paisa personality.
Okay. So first attempts failed. You finally figured out a way to go out a language where you could reach kind of a conversational level. So then you did that with, like you said, with Russian as well. So what was different then when you learned Russian versus Spanish?
When I learned Russian, I was also in Russian speaking parts of the world. I learned it so I don't know Russian. Russian is an incredibly difficult language, which I think most people know. I didn't get to any advanced level. In Russian, you can say like, do you speak Russian?
I don't, not really.
Yeah.
A couple phrases, yeah.
You can say like, I walked the dog, or like dog walked I. And it has subtle differences where you can't really do that. You can't do that in most languages. So in Russian, my approach was just learn the top 600 words or 500 words, whatever, just straight up memorize them. And then in conversation, start memorizing words and then memorize phrases. What are they going to typically ask me? How do I respond? So I have in my Anki deck, which I know that you've talked about, I don't know, 800 words and phrases, which got me a pretty decent way. Unfortunately, I was in Almaty, Kazakhstan. I got my Russian visa. I applied for a 1 month visa, I think. I go and I apply it in the embassy in Almaty, Kazakhstan. I go back to get my visa and he says, hey, I can give you a 3-year visa if you want, no extra charge or anything. So I was like, oh, da, that was great. Mm-hmm. I got a 3-year visa. That was 2019. 2020, we know what happened. Uh-huh. And then 2021, also kind of what happened. And then 2022. So my visa expired. So my Russian has greatly diminished, but I still have my flashcards, which are a treasured asset for me. And I very much look forward to going back. Moscow is actually one of my favorite cities I've ever been to. I travel the world. I stay in a city for about a month. Yeah, I love big cities. It was big city. I love that it stays light until midnight, depending on what time of the year you're going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I thought the people were, so the expectations was Russian people are unfriendly, right? Mm. At least that's my expectation, what I thought. they were so friendly. It was so surprising. Yeah, but that's why I liked it. And for some other reasons as well. It was the cleanest, biggest city I've ever been to. Mm.
So tell me more about your flashcards. Because we talked a little bit now about... So just for anyone who's not familiar, Anki is it's a spaced repetition flashcard system. Very powerful. You can modify it, customize it as you want, or you can keep it very, very simple. So if you right now are like, open up your Russian flashcard deck, what are we going to see? What's going to be on the front of the card? What's going to be in the back of the card?
The thing, I just want to make a little more plug for Anki, because in addition to language, I love this app. It's free on the Android. I think it costs $20 on the iPhone. It allows you to memorize.
Yeah, we iPhone users have to subsidize the rest of y'all. So you're welcome.
It's so strange why that is, but it's not a subscription. It's only $20.
It's a one-time deal. Yeah, I think it's...
For the utility that thing gives me, I would pay a lot more than that. It allows you to memorize anything in a way that's so easy, you don't even really know you're memorizing it. And the key is because you create the flashcards. You can go out and buy flashcards if you want. Don't do that. Create your own flashcard. That's the key. Once you're done creating it, that's 90%. So I would, when I learned Spanish at the beginning, I would create, I think it was 50 cards a day or something like that. And you create one card and then you actually create three cards. Because it'll verbally pronounce the word. Okay, you have to spell it out. It will give you an image and then you have to remember what that word is. And then it'll give you that word and you have to remember what it is in your target. You have to remember what it is based on the picture. So what you're going to find is one of those three cards. I have it organized into, at this point, probably too many decks. I have by year so that I can, that kind of helps me keep track. Okay, the ones in 2019, I kind of all know. So I go back to that only when I've done everything else. Then my favorite deck is just colloquial, just colloquial things like Se Fue la Paloma is like the idea. I lost the idea. Like fun things like that. Mm-hmm. And that helps me communicate to locals that I'm high. My level is higher than it actually is when I add a few of these things in. And that's the other trick that I have, which I think you're referring to, is like I learned this early on. And I disobeyed my rule once recently when I was in Playa del Carmen for my brother's wedding. Conversation is so strange that you can respond any way and the conversation will flow. As soon as you say, I don't understand,
right,
then the conversation just flatlines. So I was in Playa del Carmen and I was sitting at this table and then the whole restaurant was open. It was like an outdoor food truck. The whole restaurant was open. I'm sitting here on my phone at my own like circular table and some guy comes and sits to my left. Fine. And then somebody else sits to my opposite side of the table. Someone sits to my right. The whole table fills up. Everything else is open. The full table. So I'm feeling a little bit awkward because I'm like, do I leave? Like, do I stay? Luckily, one of them, you know, was like, oh, we kind of took over your table. And I said, yeah, oh, that's okay. Haha. And then some guy on my right said something to me and I couldn't understand anything he said, just something about the water I was drinking. Mm. And I had him repeat and he repeated and I still had that blank look on my face. And he looked at me like, he actually looked at me like he wanted to kill me. Like he had this like really upset look on his face. And that was kind of the end of the conversation with that really stellar opportunity right there.
Yeah. It's tough. I mean, you of course can try to keep the conversation going with verbal fillers and question words and that thing. But at some point it takes two to tango, right? If they're not willing to kind of meet you halfway, that's kind of on them too. Sounds like that was more, or at least partly a him thing, not just a you thing.
Yeah. I'll accept that.
Yeah. Yeah. It is funny though, right? I mean, there are people who are just really easy to talk to in certain people, certain languages, the way they talk. I mean, much in the same way you said certain teachers, they just can explain things in a way that works with your brain. It seems like there are people who their way of communicating is just really kind of puzzle piece with the way that you communicate. And you just find these certain people. And for me personally, that's always my number one filter for tutors, for language tutors, is how easy can I communicate with them? Especially once you get to that kind of intermediate level where you're doing mostly or hopefully all kind of target language practice. Yeah. Can you keep a conversation flowing with them for 30 minutes, an hour without a lot of awkward silences and what are we going to talk about next, right?
Especially as, I don't know about you, but I am a born introvert, I say. I've learned how to be more extroverted in certain situations, but I'm not a talker. I don't go to a party and I can't, you know, shoot the shit with everybody and joke and this and that. I get along with a few people who we talk about similar stuff. We have a similar mindset, which is bad for language learning, I think, because my friends who speak the best languages, they just blah, 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 blah. They'll talk to the taxi cab driver. They'll talk to this guy, that guy, that guy. So when I go to a teacher, I learn about the local culture, the local school system, the local political system. These are things that, okay, I'm learning and that I have interest in. So we'll keep it going. rather than some teachers want to talk about like sports, for example. Let's talk about sports. No, unless it's like, tell me about the local national soccer team and how the sports leagues work. But like, that didn't work with me. Or there's a lot of these exercises that are just talking to talk. And I can't do that.
Right. Like kind of language games or things to try to get you to communicate. Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that's one of the biggest advantages actually of using an online tutor is you get to decide. You get to choose the teacher or tutor, and you get to choose the topics. But that's one of the worst parts about, I think, a traditional like high school Spanish class or some kind of textbook. It's like, okay, here's the topics. They're pre-decided, predefined, and you're forced to go through them. And most of that stuff is either going to be it's going to be boring, or it's going to be not personally relevant to you. And so I think it behooves you to pick things that you're interested in.
Yeah. And I'd be curious to know your thoughts on this too, because I learned maybe too deep into my language learning process. I need to teach the teacher, not how to teach, but how to teach me.
Sure.
So they don't know that I want to learn about, like when I'm talking, I want to talk about something that will teach me something. So I learned later on, like, okay, because at the outset, I was like, all right, they're the expert. I'm going to go and they're going to teach me. That didn't really work for me at all until I started teaching them exactly how to teach me. I have one teacher in Playa del Carmen, different teacher. And she was like, you're the only student that leads the class. And that just worked for me.
Yeah. I think that's a really important point early on to set expectations with your tutor, teacher. What do you want? What do you want out of this? How do you want to be corrected? What topics do you want to talk about? Do you want to just have free conversation? Do you want to select a movie or a TV show or an article or a book or something ahead of time before the session to talk about? And then you create some context there. You know, you mentioned in your book, there's common vocabulary, but then there's personally relevant vocabulary. Like you want to learn what is the word for carbohydrate, protein, fat, muscle groups, right? Because those are things you're interested in. Those things you're going to want to talk about, you know, when you go to the local gym in that country, or when you're, you know, reading a nutrition label. Those are things you want to know. I'm exactly the same way. I want to get deep on linguistic concepts and, you know, what's the word for native language, target language, verb, subject, adjective, those kind of things, because I find it interesting.
They also have to, the teacher for me has to have an answer, has to know an answer. If they're a true expert, like my expertise is Airbnb. If you ask me anything about Airbnb, how to rank high in Airbnb, I'm going to know the answer. And I'm going to have some experiences to highlight that answer. There oftentimes teachers, they need to prepare before. And so I'll ask them a question and ask them why.
Yeah. Which is why I asked you earlier about, have you studied with a non-native fluent teacher? Because in my experience, native speakers, unless they've had a lot of training and a lot of experience, they don't know the whys because they didn't learn that way. You know, they just learned through immersion. And
interesting.
The non-native speaker, they know the why, because they had to learn it themselves as an adult. And so I've found the most effective thing is a mix. If possible, you find a non-native fluent speaker tutor who can answer the whys really well. And then you have a native speaker, they know the what perfectly.
Wow. I can't believe I'm learning that hack 6 years into my language learning journey. That is so obvious, but like, I will next go. That makes a lot of sense. Now I will say the best teachers I have, they do have a lot of experience in grammar and this stuff. So they do know those
questions. Right.
But it's nevertheless a very valid point to draw a parallel to me learning salsa. I typically learn with a guy.
Because they know your part.
Yeah.
Interesting. That makes so much sense, actually.
Yeah. He can show me both. So when we're practicing, he's taking the feminine spot.
But he knows what you're supposed to do as the, okay. Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. And the best female teachers know how to do the male spots as well. But I find that the males, it's more likely that they are better at teaching both.
What languages are you learning now or wanting to learn next?
Well, I'm still learning Spanish. I'm still to get to that very high level. But my top three languages would be Russian, Portuguese, and Spanish, because I see myself living there in Brazil, principally. Latin America, and I like Eastern Europe, including Russia. The other one I could see myself learning next, an easy next one, would be Italian. I even understand them kind of just like, sometimes I'm like, are you speaking Italian or not? Because when I'm listening, I'm understanding, I don't know, 80%, 85% of language anyways. So someone's speaking Italian on the other side of the room and I'm understanding some stuff. So it, for me, my brain, it's like, is this Spanish or you're not understanding it, but you don't understand 100% of it Spanish either. So it's like, are they, so that would be a next one I would probably do.
Yeah. Italian seems really fun. I've just barely scratched the surface on it, but I really, really enjoyed it. And having, you know, focused most of my language career on Japanese and Mandarin Chinese with different writing systems completely, it was kind of a nice, like, oh, I could just start. I already could read this, you know, there's a nice change of pace.
I heard when you study Mandarin, maybe this is true for Japanese as well, some people just don't even learn how to write because it's so complex or it's so different.
That's true. And that you do hear that advice, like just focus on listening and speaking. Yeah. And I do agree to a point, but not for the same reason that people expect. I do think you eventually should learn to read and write whatever language you're learning, just because it unlocks so much more of the language, the people, the culture, the history, and resources. I mean, if you can read, then subtitles and Netflix are unlocked for you as like another like source of reading input, right? But I don't think you should get too worried about it in the very beginning, because this is one way in which, and adults and children are very different, but one way in which I do agree in the kind of order of operations, the natural order, you didn't learn to read and write English until you already know, you're already fluent basically as a speaker. And then when you learn to read and write, you were attaching that to that innate fluency already. And that tends to be much more efficient. Whereas if you look at like how they learn English in Japan, for example, it's completely backwards. They start with reading and writing. They memorize, you know, the spelling of the words, but they can't actually pronounce them. And so they develop all these really bad pronunciation habits, for example. They write the pronunciation for those words in Japanese kana, their syllabary system. And so they go through 10 years of education. They've done all these tests. They spent all this effort. And I feel really bad for them because it's not their fault. You know, they are very diligent learners. Their system just is absolutely atrocious. Like if you were to design the worst possible language learning approach, it would be that.
Especially for English, where the Spanish, great, because it's every word, you pronounce every word how it's spelled, but English, that's not the case at all.
Yeah, not at all. It's like French. It's like the spelling and the pronunciation, like, it's like, how does that create this? Like, it's crazy. Yeah.
Going back to the reading though in Mandarin, that's so, it surprises me somewhat because it's almost, with how much we text nowadays, reading has always been just kind of automatic. I'm automatically going to learn how to read and write because I'm texting so much more than I'm talking.
Yeah, and that's a good point. And you don't have to write Chinese characters by hand almost ever anymore, unless you want to. I like it. I enjoy that. I've learned like calligraphy and I really enjoy that kind of as more of a cathartic, it's almost like a meditation. But on a daily level, if you want to learn Japanese or Mandarin Chinese, you're going to be typing on a keyboard or texting on a phone. And to do that, you're actually entering English letters. And then you just have to select, there'll be a little pop-up of the characters and you select the one. So your recognition needs to be right. But that's much, much, much easier than having to actually write it by hand. It's just like English, right? Like we know we recognize lots of English words, but you'll find yourself, if you ever have to write it by hand, you're like, oh, wait, how do you spell that? We forget the order of the letters sometimes, even as native speakers. It's kind of the same thing. So I know you did a bit of Russian, and in the book you mentioned that having to learn a new alphabet, speaking of these different writing systems, was kind of throws a wrench in the works a little bit, right? Was there anything that you did differently or had to kind of change your approach on having to learn Cyrillic or non-Latinate or non-Romance language?
How I did it for all three languages was I found this program online which teaches you the elemental sounds of the language, of which I forget how many there are on Russian, but there's something like 25 to 50. The whole language is based on these elemental sounds.
Was this Mimic
and
Method?
Mimic Method. Mimic Method.
Yeah, he doubts
it. Yeah, I highly recommend it. That's like the first thing you do so that you can understand the sounds. That's the first thing I did. And then that made pronouncing a little bit easier, hearing a little bit easier. And that's been, I can imagine I'd do that for any language I learn in the future.
Yeah, that's a really important point, which I think lines up really well with what we're just talking about of kind of the order of operations, is you got to start with sounds. You talk about that in the book. And I think that's such an important point that people miss, is they want to jump to words and phrases and conversations, and understandably it's like that's your end goal, right? You want to talk, you want to use words and sentences, but if you don't have that foundation, that phonetic foundation, you're not going to be comprehensible. You're not going to comprehend, and whatever comes out of your mouth is not going to be comprehensible.
And it only, it's not actually difficult. It takes, for me at least, for the languages that I've learned, it took a week or two, I forget, but it wasn't that long to get a mastery of the sounds. And the international alphabet was something new I learned with learning languages. And I find that so fascinating, where all the sounds in the world, no matter what language, are put into this international.
Yep. Oh, it's fantastic. If I had to pick one tangible thing I took away from my linguistics classes in university, it was the IPA. Like, the International Phonetic Alphabet has helped me with every language I've learned, with English teaching, for example. Because the beauty of it, as you're probably going to get to, is it's a one-to-one relationship. Every symbol in the IPA can be pronounced only one way. And so if you learn that, and yeah, you're golden.
Another thing that I learned, which I think all language learners learn, is how your position of your tongue and your lips matter. So you get that, you start to build that connection. And so if I'm pronouncing ah or whatever I in English, I know where my lips are. So even though that's a different sound in a different language, I know how to produce it. At least there's subtle differences, but at least I'm halfway there, at least with the IPA.
Yeah, it's a pretty ingenious system, actually. And I wish that was something that, I mean, honestly, I think everyone should learn this. Even if they're not ever going to learn a foreign language, I think it's really, really fascinating.
It's a different, totally different school of knowledge that was unknown to me at that time.
It seems like extra work. I think a lot of people might balk at the idea of, like, wait a minute, you want me to learn the sounds of Spanish, and now you're asking me to learn this whole other alphabet and system. It seems like a tangent that's not worth the effort, but it's actually not wasted effort. It's not a distraction. It's not a tangent. It's actually the most direct path forward.
Well, you would only learn, I mean, for me, I would only learn the Spanish sounds of the International Phonetic Alphabet.
Right.
So for me, it made a lot of sense. I was like, yeah, I am taking a week or two not speaking, just learning the sounds. But I also, it just made sense to me. I was like, I think I'm speeding up my learning by doing this.
Right. And not developing bad habits. Because again, I think a lot of people, they will, if they jump right into trying to speak Spanish and going by the spelling, they're going to bring in a lot of English habits. You know, they're going to stress words. They're going to put English stress, for example, on Spanish words. They're going to probably pronounce the vowels like a gringo, right? Not the way they're actually pronounced.
But the bad habits will come. You'll develop some bad habits.
You can't avoid them all, for sure. Which is why correction is so important in your tutoring sessions too. I know you mentioned this in the book, but that's something you also need to train your tutor or teacher to do, is to actually correct you. Because a lot of people won't do it naturally. They don't want to, you know, make you feel uncomfortable. They don't want to make you feel bad. They don't want to interrupt the flow of the conversation. If your goal is to be absolute high level fluency, you want them to be correcting you all the time for everything. Whereas if you just want to have basic conversations, like if you're just going to pop over to Mexico for a vacation and just have basic conversations, then you want them just to correct you in like absolute incomprehensible mistakes that would like block the flow of conversation.
I want to ask you this as well. Once you get to an intermediate level, or even a advanced intermediate level, what are some of your hacks to get? Because at this level, you're satisfied. You're easily speaking with the taxi driver, basic conversations, grocery store, barbershop. What are some hacks to get to that next level, which is where I'm at now? I'm listening to a bunch of podcasts, but I'm listening at this point passively. Mm. I think another thing I'm going to do, if I can, is speak with my local Colombian friends who speak better English than I speak Spanish. We end up speaking English. I want to speak Spanish with them. I think that would pay a lot of dividends, because they'd be able to correct me at a level that someone who just speaks Spanish wouldn't be able to correct me at.
Right. That's tough though, because you've developed a relationship based around English, and that's a hard jump, right? Going back kind of earlier, we were talking about identity and personality and who you are. So you've created now a relationship in one language, and to jump to another is really, really hard.
Okay. So that's why it's easier said than done. I'm finding it
totally. You might have to go make new friends then. That speak English at a high level, and but insist from day one that this is going to be a Spanish only relationship.
Yeah.
A big ask.
I thought that there's a basketball community here, and I went, and every now and then, typically it's the French folks who obviously speak English. But I remember thinking, like, how weird, because some of them, you knew they speak English, but they wouldn't speak to you in English. They would just do Spanish. Like, how weird. French people are weird, but you know, they're doing it right. What I've started with my friend is, I have two friends. I started saying a story will speak English, but I'll one story that I have to tell them, I'll tell them in Spanish. That's how I'm starting.
That's a good constraint. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you have a context and yeah, that's good. To your answer of how to move beyond that, I think the number one thing, if you had to just put a name on it, is deliberate practice, which is the idea of intensive error correction focused practice instead of just passive input or just having conversations. It's like, no, we're going to fix one or two things. We're going to hit it hard. It's painful. It's uncomfortable. It's not fun. It's exhausting, but that's why most people don't do it. I mean, you get to your point, you get to that kind of conversational intermediate level and you can kind of coast on that forever, but doing that kind of deliberate practice, and there's, you know, the 10,000 hour rule, which I know has come into some controversy about replicability and stuff in science, but
yeah,
I think the basic idea still holds. You need a lot of practice to go from intermediate to advanced. It's way more than from beginner to intermediate. It's almost logarithmic.
I read that book.
Frustrating. Yeah.
Outliers, I believe it was. I've read all three of his books, or three of his most popular books. And I don't know if he intentionally did this. I think he probably didn't, but it turned out to be geniusly marketed, because as I read the book, he didn't mean it to be like that. Like, it was scientific. He was just kind of about 10,000 hours.
Like a principle.
About the,
right.
Yeah. And then everyone took this as like, I think he even got sued because someone learned guitar for 10,000 hours and didn't get a band for something like that. So I was like, and then we're talking about it now because someone in a lab tried to reproduce his 10,000 hours. For me, it's like, that's crazy. It's just a,
it's a rounded, good sounding number. Right.
Yeah. It's like a marketing thing.
Right.
So good on him for that.
And also what you do in those 10,000 hours totally makes sense. I mean, you can sit on the couch and watch 10,000 hours of Netflix in your target language, you know, with or without subtitles in the target language or not. And you know, results will vary. But if you spent 10,000 hours speaking with a tutor one-on-one, you know, you've trained them to work with you the way you want. They don't let any mistake or error go uncorrected or unnoticed. Those 10,000 hours are very different qualitatively to just 10,000 hours of listening to a podcast while you do the dishes, right? We know this.
I could build a correlation between anyone who's plays sports and this. In high school, I'm a good basketball player. And in high school, freshman year, I was like, all right, this is my thing. This is my time. So basketball season is like winter season. So for the first few months, I would go to the basketball court every single day. I would, in fact, dribble with my left hand. I'd make sure my left hand was dirtier than my right hand to make sure my dribble was good. I would practice shots.
You're right-handed, I'm assuming then.
I'm right-handed, yeah.
Yeah, got it.
Yeah. I would shoot. I got really good at shooting, really good. But then in a game, I wasn't as aggressive. There's someone in my face. Now I still shot good. I still made the shots, but it was kind of passive. The ball had to come to me at the right time and I shot it and I would make it, but the it didn't correlate much at all. And that's where my basketball career fizzled out.
Interesting. Yeah. That's such a good analogy or framing here. Cause it's exactly like languages. You got to match your performance environment to your training environment as much as possible.
Yeah.
And that's where so many people go wrong is they train, well, most will train the wrong things to begin with. So in the basketball, they would be, I don't know, I don't play basketball, but they would be doing something that's not important. They'd spend all their time like
dribbling with their right hand, maybe.
With their right hand or something like that. That's right. Doing what's easy. Well, and this is to go back to deliberate practice. That's what marks deliberate practice is it's not what's easy. You're not just reviewing what you're already good at. You're not just doing your same self-introduction again or talking about the same topic again that you already know how to do. You're doing something unfamiliar or uncomfortable. You are taking one maybe grammar point, for example, that you butcher or don't quite use well.
You kind of gave an example right here, but I want to put you on the spot as well a little bit. All right. So at the beginning, it's very easy to learn. Learn the top 600 words and then keep learning that. Learn the different tenses. But then once you're done with that, I could learn some tenses a little bit more for sure. Mm-hmm. But like, I'm finding it hard where I'm like, what do I learn next? I know everything. Well, not I don't know, but I know everything. I'm quoting air quotes here in the language. Sure, I could move from 90% to 95%, but does that matter? Or maybe I'm not at 90%. Maybe I'm at 75%. So what are some specific things that you corrected, or how did you correct them, or what did you notice that you needed to correct when you were at that somewhat advanced level?
Yeah. So first I'll zoom out a little bit and say, I think it's up to the individual to decide, do you want to invest all this time and energy that it's going to take to go from intermediate to advanced, or does it make more sense to get to an intermediate level in multiple other languages? That's a really important question, depending on what you want in your life. Because a lot of people I talk to and are friends with, you know, they're so-called polyglots who speak multiple languages, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20. I do not. I'm like maybe three and some change if you add a bunch together. Because that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to go deeper on a few. But a lot of people I know, they looked at the math. They're like, why would I spend all this time to move the needle a tiny bit? Mm-hmm. When the low-hanging fruit is out there for all these other languages. So that's first caveat. Now, assuming you do want to go from intermediate to advanced, you want to spend that time for kind of minimal reward in a lot of ways. A lot of it comes down to language-specific stuff or cultural-specific stuff. So like in Japanese, for example, they have this whole system of complex honorifics. There's literally different verbs and verb forms and vocabulary you use depending on who you're talking to, who you are relative in the hierarchy, who you're talking about. It gets really complicated. And I usually tell beginner learners of Japanese, don't worry about that stuff in the beginning. First of all, you're a foreigner. They're going to see you not as a native speaker. They're going to give you a pass if you say something that a native speaker would kind of get chastised for not being properly, you know, formal or polite. So they kind of give you a pass. And there's sort of this generic formality level you can use in Japanese. That's pretty simple.
Oh, shoot. You know what? I'm sorry to cut you off.
You got
to
run.
But I have another podcast right now and I missed it yesterday and we rescheduled for today.
Okay. All good. Okay. Let's jump to this. Can you just give a 30-second wrap up? Like if somebody's starting brand new in a language, what are like the first three things they should do to get started?
I think if it's possible to understand what type of accent you want in that language is important. That's something I didn't do. Now, I don't know if it's possible because I learned before I knew where I wanted to stay. Now I'm staying in Medellin, Colombia. The locals are called paisas. They have a paisa accent. Ideally, I could have a paisa accent. Now I'm 5 years in, 6 years in. I'm not sure if that's realistically possible anymore unless I work really, really hard at it. So that's one thing. There's a bunch of different accents in Spanish from countries and in countries. And then the formula that I follow would be sounds, then words, the most popular words, then phrases, then grammar in that order.
Makes sense to me. Well, Danny, thank you very much. And I got to jump on another call. We can find out more about you at DannyBooBoo.com. I'll put a link to the show notes and check out his book, Zilch to Conversational. Danny, thanks so much. And we'll see you somewhere in the world one of these days.
Thanks for having me. I've enjoyed myself.
Thanks, Danny. Me as well. Thank you for listening to the Language Mastery Show. Again, you can find show notes at languagemastery.com/show. Before you continue on with your day, take a quick moment to choose one small tip or takeaway from today's episode to apply in your life. Listening to podcasts is a great first step, but the real magic only happens when you translate information into action. Also, if you want to help keep this show going, there are three key things you can do to help. Number one, leave a 5-star rating and a written review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whichever app you use to listen to podcasts. Number two, join my free newsletter called Language Mastery Monday, in which you get weekly tips, tools, and resources for building an effective language immersion environment anywhere in the world. And number three, if you're learning Japanese or Mandarin Chinese, check out my detailed immersion guides called Master Japanese and Master Mandarin. Both provide step-by-step instructions for how to immerse yourself in Japanese or Chinese right where you are. Learn more at JapaneseMastery.com and ChineseMastery.com. And you can use the code SHOW, that's SHOW, to get 25% off either guide. All right, we'll see you next week for another episode of the Language Mastery Show. Until then, happy learning.